Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, Odyssey, Rockfin, or Band.video, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We certainly do appreciate your amazing and continued support. I know that you have a million options out there. I think in the podcast world, you quite literally have a million options out there. So the fact that you've decided to spend some time with me does not go unnoticed, and I'm greatly appreciative of it. Hey, speaking of Iconic, they asked me to pass along a message to everyone listening and watching that if you are interested in trying out their platform, you can do so on a 10-day free trial. I put a link in the show notes. You can just click that out and try it before you buy it. You know, they've been a home to this show since we started, right around the same time they started. And it's more than just David Icke's work. Of course, all of that is there, but they're doing weekly shows. They're doing original content, original movies, a whole lot of health and wellness, which if you're into that, you're going to be really blown away at how much they have available there. So it's kind of like the Netflix of alternative media. And considering you can try it out for 10 days, I certainly do encourage it. So check out that link. Thank you to our sponsors, Chemical Free Body, the amazing CEO Ken Schwartz. He's a local to me. We've done a bunch of shows together, and I really like him personally. But I'll tell you what, his product is amazing. They are making the best C60 out there. It is available through their website, shopc60.com. You can read up all about it. You can use the promo code MACRO to save yourself some money. I've been taking it since the day they sent me the first batch. I've been taking it every single day. I've got my mom taking it. I've got my wife now taking it. I've had my cat taking it from the beginning. So I am slowly integrating the entire family into C60 Purple Power. So if you are interested, you can go to shopc60.com, use the promo code MACRO to save yourself some money, and read up on it. Because the guys that discovered the C60 carbon molecule, they won the Nobel Prize for it. It is the most powerful antioxidant known to man, and it is available, and not many people know about it. So if you're interested in increasing your energy and lifting the oxidation burden off of your cell, go check it out. Read up about it. Links are going to be in the description as well. And hey, listen, I'm going to keep beating this dead horse until I know that every single one of the listeners and viewers is prepared and ready for what is coming. In the past, earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, these things would catch you off guard. Now we know well in advance that we have supply chain issues that are going to be disruptive. You are going to want to be prepared for what is coming. My Patriot Supply, a sponsor of this show since the beginning, has built a landing page for us called preparewithmacroaggressions.com. You can check it out there. You can get a 4-week supply of food. You can get a 3-month supply of food. You can get seeds. You can get water purification, air filters, basically whatever you need to survive the coming apocalypse. Listen, again, you want to be early. You'd rather be a couple months early than a couple days late on this. This is one of these situations where we've got to be proactive. We have to think proactively. We cannot be reactive. You don't want to fight somebody for the last roll of toilet paper, or especially in this case, the last bag of rice. So take advantage of this relatively calm downtime. We know that Shanghai has their ports closed. We know what's going on in the port of Long Beach in Los Angeles. It's real issues. This is a global supply chain catastrophe that is unfolding before our eyes. And the benefit to us is that we can see it happening months in advance. So I don't care if you use my sponsor. If you are interested, go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com and buy it that way. 10 minutes of figuring that out and you'll have yourself sorted out. Or just get ready on your own. Buy extra groceries at the store. Start putting things away. Don't freak out your family. Just tell them it's for, you know, emergencies and things like that. But we'll know what we're actually talking about. So just be proactive. I'll feel a whole lot better if I know that you guys are taken care of. I know we're not going to be able to get everybody on board. But hey, the benefit of listening to alternative media is that you're going to get alternative ideas. And some of these ideas that are getting yourself prepared in advance. The mainstream media really is not interested in having you be prepared for these things. They want you fearful and in their control. So break free of their grip, plan accordingly, and check out the sponsors if you're so inclined. Our guest is author Mark Eglinton, who I'm really excited to talk to today. Now, those of you on the audio, you are not going to notice any difference. Those of you watching video, Mark's turned his camera off for this one. If you want to see Mark's handsome face, you're going to have to pay for it on his OnlyFans account. I'm just telling you right now, this stuff is not coming for free. Mark Eglinton, the author of No Domain, I guess we're going to call it the autobiography of John McAfee. Hey, Mark, how you doing? Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. I just want to lift my oxidization burden now after that intro of yours.
Please do. Feel free.
Well, listen, you can call it that. I mean, the autobiography of John, and I'll explain how this all happened when we get into this conversation. But yeah, this is kind of what it's turned into. And this is what it was meant to be at the beginning of when John and I started talking. But it's quite a complicated process, and I'm looking forward to talking to you a bit about how that all happened.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to talking to you about it too. I read the whole book. I highly recommend it. It is a great book. I think my audience is into, and we appreciate a guy like John McAfee, and you can appreciate him without signing off on everything that he does. And I know that there were some, let's just say, bizarre stories of what he was into sexually in Belize that were coming out. And so there's a lot of information about him. I don't know how much of that was actually true. I don't know how much of that was just designed to make him look crazy. He is, or was, a little bit crazy to begin with. So it's not as far-fetched. You know, I mean, you can say whatever you want about John McAfee and people go, well, could be true. I mean, he was into all of this stuff. So, but let's start with this, because the reason why I said it was kind of sort of an autobiography is because you guys partnered up early on to write this as an autobiography, but John didn't make it really. I guess you finished writing the book, but he disappeared into a Spanish prison and then, according to official sources, died by suicide after about an 8-month or so stay there. We'll get into that. But first of all, how do you find John McAfee, or does John McAfee find you to write this book?
It's actually quite easy. Just for backstory, my world is co-writing, whether it's John McAfee, whoever it is, musicians, sports people. That's what I do. I co-write for people who don't want to write their own book, who don't have the inclination, the energy, the ability to write their own book.
You did James Hetfield's book for Metallica?
Correct. Yeah, that kind of stuff. So yep. that's what I do. And, you know, I look for people to work with. I look for subjects that interest me. Sometimes they come to me. Sometimes they come via agents or publishers. It varies enormously. But this happened one night. I was literally sitting on Twitter looking through John McAfee's posts. And I'd already followed him, and he'd followed me back some time before. So I just sent him a message and said, do you ever fancy writing a book? Because I can't believe there isn't one. And he came back to me immediately and said, how much will it cost me? And the answer was nothing. And from that point onwards, we kind of had this awkward feeling out process that we did, combination of it on Twitter, the rest of it on Skype Messenger, and ultimately Skype video call, where we kind of sized each other up. I sized up whether he was serious. He sized up whether I was the kind of guy that would kind of tolerate his stuff. And eventually we got it to the point where we agreed to write this autobiography with me co-writing for him. And that's how it all started. This was all, just to give people an idea, October of 2019. Okay. And this relationship continued up until almost before he died.
Wow. So for those that don't know, well, we'll paint a little backstory on John McAfee for just he's the founder of McAfee Antivirus, which was, I guess, purchased by Computer Associates. Did they purchase it?
Oh, I mean, McAfee Antivirus started off as the original antivirus package that was available to corporations in the late 80s. He was first to that. He beat everyone else to that punch. And John had no willingness or desire to ever be a corporate type. John was a guy who was a genius programmer, enjoyed the battle of defeating hackers and virus makers in these early days. And then
he respected them too, which I thought was quite noble of him. He knew he was battling these hackers, but there was a part of him that respected the fact how good they were.
100%. He did. He enjoyed that battle. And, I mean, to the extent he ended up hiring some of them afterwards.
Yeah.
But this trajectory moved very fast, because this was the kind of dawning of the computer age. You had, you know, Silicon Valley was exploding. John reached this point where, instead of just working in a sitting room in his house doing kind of programming and message boards, all of a sudden he had a company, and he just didn't want it. And he told me on many occasions that he had no willingness to be a Bill Gates or Richard Branson, somebody who made a load of money and stayed in that business. And I asked him, why not? And he said, I just don't want to deal with corporate people. I'm much more interested in dealing with drug dealers, with homeless people, et cetera, et cetera. This was an affinity that John had. And as a result of that, he walked away from this business at a very early stage. I mean, the company had got huge. He benefited from the sale of his assets in it and basically walked away. And this was 1992, a long time ago. People think that John was in business for a long time. He really wasn't.
Yeah. Yeah. He cashed. I mean, so the accounts I heard, 100 million.
I think that was conservative. That was the number he told me. Okay. I think it was more than that. He basically just took his shares in the company, the proceeds from those, and just walked away. He didn't.
Yeah, he mentioned sell. You mentioned in the book, he said he paid $50 million in taxes over his lifetime, and he was done paying taxes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And he walked away. And this facilitated thereafter just this bizarre life of doing precisely what he wanted. In the name of freedom, in the name of just being blown by the wind of life, as he described it. And, you know, people have, I've laughed about this a lot, and it's a mindset I would like to get into, but it's also a mindset that if I got into, I'd probably be homeless in 24 to 48 hours, because it's much easier to do this stuff with $100 million in your pocket. Yeah. You try and kind of live this life on a normal level, it's very difficult. So I got to qualify that and say, yeah, sure, I get the freedom thing, but with a lot of money, it's much more doable.
For sure. But he did have this sort of work the bare minimum so that you could accumulate a little bit of money so that you could disappear and do the fun stuff. Well before McAfee, but before he was doing the antivirus software, back when he was working in New York and Brazil and London and these places, it seemed like he would work a little while. He'd go in, he'd show them what he could do in the first week, as he said, you know, I gotta show you what I'm good for. Then he would immediately negotiate that he was not coming into the office except for maybe on Fridays. He would work from home. And he was the original Zoom commuter before there was Zoom commuting, was he not?
Yeah, to be honest, the pre-McAfee Associates days that you've just touched on there were the most fascinating to me, because he'd never talked about them. And as you say, it wasn't a little money. I think the two keys here are, A, there was very few people like John in the 80s and the late 70s who had his ability. And B, these people were in very, very high demand in terms of what companies would pay them.
Yeah.
So this was a guy who was getting shoved off to Munich or to Rio de Janeiro or various other places in the US, paid an absolute fortune for what was ultimately a 6 or a 12 month contract. And as you say, he'd walk in on day one, slap down a sheet of paper on the desk and say, this is your system, this is how it works. And I will not be in the office, and I will appear every 2 weeks for a meeting if you need me. And from there, as you also said, he would just do the fun stuff in life. But the key is, he did have the ability to be able to do that. Again, you've got to have the expertise and the know-how to get, you know, your bosses or whoever it is you're working for on side with your mindset at the very beginning. And John knew how to do that, because John was so smart when it came to mathematics and programming.
And dealing with people too, yeah. I would say.
Agreed. He was a real understander of human nature. He knew which buttons to push with people, how to weigh up people's traits and characteristics and to get them to respond to him. It was a real skill.
There's an interesting part in the book where he's beginning this process of forming McAfee Associates accidentally, of course. Yeah. And he's partnered up with this guy, this programmer last name Yell. And this guy is a nerd of the highest order, like autistic, you know, like Asperger's off the charts, won't make eye contact, can't interact with any people. He picks this guy up. They go to some sort of emergency at some place. They have an interaction with this company that needs their help. And John and the guy is the company, I guess the guy is angry. And John, in an effort to calm him down, asks the guy, "Hey, tell me, you know, what is this about? Tell me about your kids and everything." And so the guy starts talking about his kids and he calms him down. They get in the car on the way home back. And this programmer yells, says, "How did you know to do that?" And McAfee says, what do you mean? How did you know to ask about his kids? And it threw John off, where he was like, how did you not know? The guy's going to want to talk about his kids. That's diffusing the bomb. It just went to show that, like, in this Silicon Valley world where you've got in my mind, when I'm reading that, I'm thinking he's Steve Jobs and Yell is Steve Wozniak, right? Like, absolutely, kind of like off the charts, kind of nerdy. Although Wozniak is way more personable, but that I'm the snake oil salesman and you're the hardcore tech guy, and together we're going to make this work. So I thought that it was interesting that that he just had this way about him that was very, very charming, I guess. Right.
Yeah, I think this came from, and we labored over this a lot, because I was curious where this came from. And I think the conclusion I came to was that John, because of his upbringing, he had a very abusive father who ultimately committed suicide when John was 15. But John spent his childhood trying to second guess his father's facial expressions, the sound his father's shoes made when they crossed the hallway on a particular night. He studied all of this with a view to surviving, basically. Did he need to be in his room in case his father was going to hit him? Was he safe to sit in the same room as his father on one particular evening, or was he not? This was all something that he learned very, very early on in life. And once he learned it, obviously he could apply it to anybody. And John did that. But I think it all came from that relationship with his father, which was a huge underpinning of the John McAfee persona. That relationship with father was such a huge thing, and quite a delicate issue at times for us.
Yeah, I would assume so. That's that sort of early childhood trauma heightens your sensitivities in some areas and lowers them and diminishes them in others. I would suspect that he used that that sharpened his skill set in terms of reading people, reading situations, understanding danger. There's a theme that runs through the whole book, and that is that he's very good at recognizing when the end is near and getting out about 10 minutes before everything comes down. I wonder if that was a product of a childhood where he was hypersensitive to impending doom and could feel it and see it in his father.
Yeah, I think so. I think it all came from there. And you're right, it is a theme running through. In fact, he explicitly said it. You know, I always had a feel for when doom approached.
Yeah.
And doom approached very often in John's life. So I guess if doom approaches a lot, you get used to seeing it coming. But you're right, it was always 11th hour stuff, you know, walking out the door just before the roof falls in type of thing. But I think it all came from the childhood, as you say.
Yeah. So his ability to read people, I'm curious, you couldn't have been the first person to want to write his biography, autobiography. And he would, of course, be reading you. What was it about you that he felt could handle him?
Good question. And I wasn't the first, I think it was three or four. And he was very keen to regale me with how he slapped these people away and how they all fell by the wayside, etc. And I think he did that to, I don't know whether he was testing me or not. He tested me a few times early on. And the way he did that was by calling me not at the time when we'd agreed to call. And I think he wanted to know if I would pick up any time. You know that sort of control thing, you know, if I call, will someone answer? And I did on that occasion because I had to. But thereafter, I didn't. I think I was quite strong with setting boundaries with John about when we talked. And if he wasn't on a call when he was meant to be, I kind of messaged him and said, you're meant to be here. I think there was a couple of things. I think, A, he was in a situation where he felt this was probably his last chance to write a book. He was under extreme duress. He was in hiding. I also think that we related in a certain way. I'm kind of no-nonsense, that Scottish thing. He was a UK, obviously a UK dual citizen. I don't know whether that kind of resonated a little bit or not.
Yeah.
But I just think I told him stuff straight. I didn't bullshit him at all. And I think, you know, being such a good reader of people, I think he probably got that impression very quickly that I wasn't someone that was just going to cave in. I wasn't somebody that was just going to be a sycophant. And I think he realized this is probably the best chance he's got to get that story out there. And that's ultimately what it became.
Did you like him?
Yeah, in general. Yeah, I would say I did. John was a really warm, extraordinarily warm person, both in appearance and also in his demeanor. I mean, I was always shocked by John's eyes, and you know, anyone who wants to go and have a look at pictures, John has extremely sensitive eyes in terms of they're almost effeminate, which really kind of took me by surprise because this is a tough macho sort of guy. You know, most of the time when we're on call, video calls, he was half naked, covered in tattoos, pretty disheveled, sometimes still in bed. It was pretty chaotic. But behind it all, there was these really sensitive eyes and there was a real warmth there. And The unique thing about John McAfee that differs from most people I've ever worked with is that most people don't really care about me. I'm just the vehicle to get their story told. Mm-hmm. John wasn't like that at all. John wanted to know what I felt about certain things about his life. He also wanted to know about my life. I think there was a real kind of back and forth there that he probably hadn't had with people before that he could feed off. And I think it encouraged him because he told me on many occasions, you know, I've never talked about this before, but the way we're doing this is really making me want to do it. So I think to answer your question at the beginning, yes, I did like him on certain levels. And I think he liked me in the same way. He said to me on one occasion, you know, I'm using you here. And I said, yep. And likewise. And that was understood. I was using him to get this book out there. And I wanted to create this great book. Equally, he was using me as the means to do it. And I think, you know, once we understood that, everything was good.
Well, of course. And I understand that too. I'm a, besides hosting this podcast, I'm an author as well. And I would, and that's the arrangement. That's the arrangement people have when they do interviews like this. I'm going to use your platform to promote my book, and you are going to use my content for your platform. And it's sort of an unwritten rule, and there's nothing inherently negative about it. I guess you could abuse that situation, but that sounded reasonable. So he was, and you could, and I guess it's fair to say you can like John McAfee without signing off on everything that he does, correct?
100%, and not just John McAfee, everybody. And one of the things I took out of this whole process is that John, more than anyone I've ever dealt with, had this great sort of relationship with himself in terms of his faults, his qualities. All of that was this just big mixture. As all of us have. And he, you know, which means that there are certain things about John that are fantastic. John was a fantastic storyteller. He could be very warm. He was very generous. He was very kind. He was also very jealous. He also had many other negative qualities that he would admit to, but that's just all part of the human condition. And I suppose went into the relationship not as aware of that as he was. And I became more on board with that whole, you know, accepting the different aspects of myself as much as I accepted the different aspects of John. And, you know, I didn't need to sign off on everything that he did. I mean, there are aspects to John's life that I just didn't approve of and told him, you know, this is somebody who was accused of murder. At no point would I approve of that. There was a few other things that I don't approve of as well, but I think you have to take it as a whole. You look at the human being you've got in front of you, and, you know, John wasn't, no one charged John with murder, but I just kind of put that into the whole picture and thought, well, okay, this may have happened. It also may not have happened, but, you know, do I judge him on that thing alone? And I never did. I looked at the whole picture.
And you didn't think he murdered his neighbor in Belize?
I never did. No. I never did. And, you know, there's a passage in the book where I kind of go through this bit of mental to and fro of my own about it. Mm-hmm. Would I want to endorse this product if or even for it to exist if I felt that happened? And it might sound a bit sort of worthy of me to have taken that line. That's just how I felt at the time. But looking at his body language and the way he talked to me based on lots of conversation, it wasn't an isolated conversation about the incident in Belize. My strong view was that he didn't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I got the feeling early on that the Belize situation was made to paint him in a certain light for a variety of reasons.
John was framed in Belize. I think that's basically the long and short of it. And granted, he contributed to that, got involved because John does. He meddles in things that he shouldn't meddle in, gets himself in situations he shouldn't be in. But that's what happens when you do that. And that was kind of textbook stuff, I would say.
Oh, he was certainly asking for it in Belize, the things 100%. That he was doing.
And I mean, lucky it didn't happen. And he had a similar situation prior to that in Molokai, one of the islands in Hawaii. Yeah. He was very close to a similar situation for all the same reasons, meddling in local affairs, you know, trying to tackle the drug situation in places that's been existing like that for many years. Sooner or later, you're going to offend somebody. And, you know, he got away with it in Molokai and didn't get away with it in Belize. And that's just John. John meddled.
I think what's interesting about him is that there's so obviously two different sides to this guy. And he talked about this openly about how it was very important for him to love both sides, the good side and the bad side. He would recognize how jealous he was. This dichotomy was very, it was fascinating. And it also ran through the whole book where he would openly and blatantly brag about his early years, about the amount of drugs he did and how off the wall this was and how out of his fucking mind he would be on cocaine and everything else. And then he would go to Molokai and try and rid them of the drug problem. And then he'd go to Belize in Orange Walk and try to rid them of the drug problem. And it was like, brother, you are a full-blown drug, or at least you had been a full-blown drug addict. It was wild to me. And then later started doing drugs again. So he was, a fascinating guy, probably maybe schizophrenic a little bit. I don't know. I mean, I hate to try and be an armchair psychologist and diagnose this guy that I've never met before, but it seemed like he had two very distinct personalities. Did you find that during the writing of this?
100%. And as I said before, I embraced that in the end. I found that quite liberating. And I'm sure he did too, because it makes life a lot easier if you can embrace both sides of you, because by embracing them, you acknowledge that they exist.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people go through life denying one particular side of themselves or aspects of themselves. I certainly have. But I found it quite liberating, that kind of conversation. And I think John did as well, because it kind of gives you free rein to do the kind of things that you've just described. You know, John did take drugs up until 1987. And then between 1987 and 2011, he took no drugs whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And in between, he, as you say, it's kind of like people who give up smoking, who were longtime smokers, they become the most sort of anti-smoking people around. John was kind of like that for these intervening years. And I remember saying to him, listen, why did you do drugs again after so long not doing it? He said, well, you know, certain situations, I know there are certain situations that will force me into doing them. Duress and, you know, stress and whatever being two of them. And I was under that situation. But I always got the impression John knew how to use drugs. And we had quite a lot of conversations that didn't end up in the book about the sort of mechanics of drug use. Something I found it quite interesting, because I'm somebody who's never taken drugs. So I was kind of the doofus saying, so what would happen if I took LSD type of thing? Right. And John would tell me, but he had a great understanding as to how to use drugs. And I think they were used for a purpose for him rather than just, I mean, in the early days, I mean, people talk about Silicon Valley. What fascinated me about Silicon Valley and drugs was that the drugs weren't for fun. The drugs in Silicon Valley back in the early 80s were so that people could stay up for 2 days and get work done. Yeah. You know, speed was an essential part of Silicon Valley because there just weren't enough hours in the day. I didn't understand that. John explained it very well. You know, we just had to get stuff done. And the only way you can stay awake is being on speed. So John understood the uses. And I've forgotten what your question was. But yes, he did become very anti-drugs in the intervening years. And that almost got him in a lot of trouble.
I remember a great commercial of his where he was rambling on about something. He had several women behind him, put his head down, came up with cocaine all over his nose and continued on like it was nothing. I remember watching that going, I'm not a cocaine user. I've never done cocaine in my life, but I saw that and I thought, you know, I kind of appreciate the honesty of this guy. You know, I kind of appreciate the fact that he just doesn't care what other people are going to think. Did you get the feeling that that was any of that part was an act, or can you just not can you not live this way for 75 years with that being any sort of fake facade? I mean, was this the real John McAfee, or was he playing it up for the cameras?
100%. I mean, John did like to play it up. I mean, he knew what the touch points were, and that was one of them. That advert you're talking about, which is the uninstall McAfee skit.
Yeah.
You know, in response to people who still send him emails now saying, how do I get McAfee off my laptop? That was that, and it was also in response to some rumors on online that he'd been snorting bath salts, which wasn't true. I mean, John knew what the sort of touch points were and played upon them. But in terms of being authentic, in terms of caring about what people think, John was 100% authentic. He literally did not care what people thought of him. And again, you're looking for somebody to make you feel liberated by life, John McAfee certainly achieved that.
Well, and part of this liberation was sexual liberation as well. And there is an undeniable theme that, you know, some of these were subtle themes running through the book, an undeniable out in your face component of this book and his entire life is his relationship with women. And he had lots of relationships with lots of women. And he, from his point of view, what I took from the book was that he perceived himself as somebody that was always very upfront with these women. I'm not going to be faithful. I'm kind of a shithead. I love you right now and everything's great. And then when things fizzle out, he was quick to say, well, goodbye. But it seemed to me that he wanted to, or maybe even did, stay in some sort of good graces with some of these women, because sometimes they kind of circled back. He'd reunite with them after a while and they'd go on adventures together. What did you take? What was John McAfee's relationship with women like?
I mean, you covered it there, but I mean, it was this dichotomy again, another dichotomy, and there was many of them in his life, you know, and you touched on it, you know, on one side of him. I mean, my main question to him was, why did you keep getting married? This is crazy. You kept getting married to people and it just makes no sense. He said, well, here's the thing. There's one side of me that when I'm in a relationship with a woman, I can be the most attentive. I can go out for dinner. We can go to the theater. We can go for nice walks. I can be the perfect husband. That is in me. Equally, I can be sitting alone in my apartment or whatever and feel like I need sex, and I will go and find sex. Both of those are me, and both of those are simultaneous, which makes being in a relationship with somebody extremely difficult, because, you know, sooner or later he is going to be unfaithful. And as you mentioned, was perfectly upfront about that with everybody he was with, which leads me to believe that they must have made a decision at an early stage. Is this something I'm willing to tolerate, or is this something I'm willing to not tolerate? You know, he's given them the choice. You know, as you say, I'm a bit of a shithead. It's probably going to go bad, but while we're together, it will probably be quite good type of thing. And they all bought into it. And I think that kind of honesty probably is the reason why some of these relationships kind of circled back. I don't think it was ever a sort of horrible screaming match where, you know, you're changing locks and houses and stuff. I don't get the impression it was ever like that. I always thought it was just people that separated, went their different ways with good wishes. And if their paths crossed again for whatever reason, then in John's case, they often did. Everything was reasonably amicable. I don't think any of his ex-wives ever hated him. I don't think it was that kind of relationship at all. I think it was like, yeah, that's just John. He was John, and it was what it was. And there was many people like that. And, you know, as a result, his suggestion that there might be 47 biological children out there in the world sounds pretty plausible.
Yeah, after reading the book, it seems low to me, frankly. Yeah. The amount of shenanigans he was up to, but even within the sphere of the women in his life, there was a break there where he would have the women that he was in relationships and that he married, and then he would have this other batch of women that were sort of the underbelly of society, the prostitutes and drug addicts, and sort of in that he would be simultaneously trying to save them a little bit. Did you get that feeling? I mean, what was that about that? His, you know, and again, back to this split personality almost, I mean, these loving relationships where he would buy the, you know, the Porsche Boxster for the wife and she'd complain that it wasn't a 911 or what. And then he'd be simultaneously trying to save Janice from her pimp, you know?
No, all of that. And that, again, I think there was a messiah complex there. And I think that, again, particularly in Belize, and I think the Belize story regarding the women has been twisted significantly, A, in the press, and B, in that Showtime documentary that went out about the time down there.
Yeah,
I always found it a bit unsavory that there was suggestion that was made that these women were with John unwillingly in Belize. That kind of annoyed me, because that wasn't the case. You know, John set himself up in the jungle in Belize with this, you know, it was ostensibly he was researching plant antiseptics, etc. At the same time, his old college in Roanoke, Virginia, gave him an honorary doctorate. That created a difficult situation whereby all of a sudden he was Dr. John McAfee.
Right.
And the people in Belize didn't realize that he wasn't a real doctor. So what you had was people knocking on his door in Belize, young women with babies and just young women saying, you know, Dr. McAfee, can you help me? he felt a responsibility to help people, whether they be people knocking on his door, whether they be prostitutes who are being given a hard time by pimps. He felt a responsibility to save these women. And consequently, in Belize, the women who were living with him in the jungle, and at one point there was six or seven, these were people who wanted to be with him for obvious reasons. John had money, he was charismatic, the lifestyle that he could give them in his home was worlds apart from what they were used to in Orange Walk, which was basically a slum. So this worked both ways. John liked having these women around, and I'm sure there was sexual aspects to it. But at the same time, they liked being with him. And I think that's one of the injustices that has been painted about John quite often, is that, I mean, almost suggesting that John was somebody who trafficked women, etc. I've seen that suggesting that miles from that, the situation that, right, that he was always in. These were willing people who wanted to be with John.
And in Orange Walk, after a number of mothers with their starving babies come to Dr. McAfee for advice on how to fix their babies, he said, "Your babies are starving. Let's." Yep. And what did he do? He built a food pantry or
a lunch hall for kids in the local town, where people who had no money, who had no money to buy food, could turn up and be served free meals. I mean, that's another side of John that John did have, this sort of philanthropic, benevolent side to him, where, you know, if there's a problem in a place, whether it be Molokai in Hawaii or whether it be Belize, you know, if there's a problem, I'm going to try and fix it. And that's one thing that I don't think he gets enough credit for. You know, he fixed the ferry service in Belize. He fixed, right, he did the lunch hall, cleaned drugs out of the area. I mean, he did have this desire to make things better. And I think he deserves a lot of respect for that.
Absolutely. But he was not above making things better in, let's just say, unusual ways, like hiring the most dangerous hitman in Central America to clear out an area of a city of overrun with drug dealers. Tell that story about what he did with this situation.
Yeah, this was a name that popped up. I don't mind mentioning it. Rodwell was his name, and I just had images of this enormous sort of NFL offensive tackle sized guy down in Belize, who was formerly in the police, but kind of created this position for himself as a sort of, I don't know what you'd call him, sort of militia / I don't know what you call him. Anyway, John found him, as John always did, and said, "Listen, I've got this problem. My girlfriend, one of the girls that he was seeing, is getting harassed by her pimp. There's drug dealers everywhere. And, you know, I just don't think the area that she's living in is very safe." And this Rodwell guy says, "So what do you want me to do?" And I think Rodwell thought that John wanted these people killed.
Right.
John said, I just want them scared, you know, made them go away type of thing. And what Rodwell eventually ended up doing was turning up at these houses with a pickup truck full of hoodlums, knocking on the door, laying a body bag out on the ground outside these homes, and saying, you know, "I'll come back here at midday. If you're not out of this house, you'll be in that bag," type of thing.
Right.
Which sounds just madness. And apparently this area of drug dealers was cleared out by midday. And that's what John did. He just tasked this guy to clear it out, and these people listened and cleared off.
But in typical John McAfee style, this comes with unintended consequences. And the unintended consequences in this case is that most of those drug dealers that were cleared out were kicking back part of their proceeds to the number two guy in Belize in the government, which would explain why the government went so hard after John McAfee, correct?
Exactly. Exactly. That was the thing. I mean, it was bad enough that he was going in there as this gringo, as he always called himself, trying to make this very native area better. That offends people. But when you start meddling in the proceeds of the drug trade, which, as you mentioned, were being kicked back to the government, you become very unwelcome very quickly. John became a pariah in that part of Belize within months. And, you know, it was a matter of time before his house was raided, as it was. And, you know, they claimed he was making meth there, which he wasn't. you know, and ultimately he had to leave that area and go back to his beachfront property in a more westernized part of Belize and basically hole himself up. That's what happened. He became so victimized and wanted by the Belize government, he eventually just had to live in an armed compound and ultimately flee the country when he was framed for that murder. But yeah, John just pushed the buttons until there was nowhere else to go, and ultimately he had to leave.
Yeah, his time in Belize, for those that don't know Belize, I became interested in Belize in 2007. I went down there. I wound up buying a small island that I recently just sold. So Belize has always been on my mind. When John McAfee was having his situations in Belize, it was a double whammy for me because I was fascinated with John, but I was also a landholder in Belize too. So I was like, oh, I'm really interested in this. So there's two sides of Belize. There's the mountainous side, and then there's the coastal side, and even out off the coast, there is a long running island called Ambergris Key with San Pedro there. And so he had a place in San Pedro on that Ambergris Key, which is a touristy destination. And yep, also had, when they say he went into the jungle, that's more mainland Belize, kind of up the hill in an area called Orange Walk. And that's where that's the non-touristy area. That's where the locals live. That's where the drug trade was happening. So he gets into trouble there with the authorities, pulls back to his more touristy beach compound in San Pedro, but he brings, now he's on the radar. So now he brings security with him, and he winds up sticking out like a sore thumb. Not that he didn't already before, but now he's got armed guards at this compound in San Pedro, and people are going, what is happening here? So how did that all, how long did that last? How long was that process between when he was chased out of Orange Walk or decided to leave and move back to San Pedro before he eventually had to leave there, fleeing to Guatemala?
Yeah, no, months. I mean, as you say, back in San Pedro, heavily fortified house. He was also at this time doing some various double dealing with, and there was a number of gangs in Belize, and. He was never totally sure which of these gangs was on his side or against him. And he befriended certain elements within these gangs and trying to figure out who of them were being tasked by the government to perhaps bring him in. There was a very tense period during these months where John didn't really know where he stood. And, you know, he might have become a little bit paranoid. Well, justifiably so, to be honest, because he was under a lot of stress. And
was he back on drugs at this point?
No. He was okay. I mean, he was in the mode of, you know, sleeping with one eye open and one finger on the trigger of the shotgun in his bed type of thing, which isn't normal. But he,
maybe for him it is.
Yeah, it became pretty normal. But yeah, he was under a lot of stress. And I think he always felt that there was going to be a D-Day one way or the other, however it happened, whether he got killed by a gang member, whether the government appeared and bundled him off to jail or whatever. And I always got the impression he knew that his days were numbered. You know, he'd mentioned things like, you know, the Coast Guard boat going up and down the coast and every night shining their light into his home on the beachfront. He just felt, you know, I'm being lent on here. Yeah. And sooner or later, something's going to happen. And something did happen. His next door neighbor was found dead the day after John's dogs, of which he had many, were found poisoned. And I mean, really, when you look at it, it's so obvious. It's such an obvious setup. You know, John was very fond of dogs. All of a sudden, his dogs are poisoned, you know. The suggestion that he would go next door and shoot his neighbor or have him killed was just so ridiculously obvious that it didn't bear thinking about. But that's what ended up happening. And at that point, John knew that this was the D-Day that he'd been fearing. Yeah. The government were framing him for this murder, and he just had to leave. And going back to your original question, this was weeks, months after leaving the jungle.
Right. So it looks suspicious when your next door neighbor turns up dead, of course. And so for the casual observer, it could look as though, hey, somebody poisoned his dogs. Then the next day, the neighbor winds up dead. And then John McAfee goes on the run. Clearly, he did it. Case closed. Let's bring him in. But that actually wasn't really the case, as you said. It was a setup by some dirty Belizean either gangs or government or more likely both. Yeah. So then he decides he's got to make a break for it, but he can't do it. He goes in a sort of unusual route. He goes to, instead of leaving right away, he instead goes to the most populated part of Belize City and holds up in the top of a Chinese restaurant.
Something like that. Yeah, it was great stuff.
I mean, you couldn't make this up. This is such a crazy story I love all of it. I mean, it has to be a Chinese restaurant, right?
Yeah, it was like a Chinese restaurant. I said, why the Chinese? And he said, they say nothing. They're not going to give your position away to anyone. And not only did he hold himself up there, he hold himself up disguised as a very much older. He disguised himself as basically a disabled man. He was walking around with a cane and you know, he talked me through all the various mechanisms as to how you can change your face by packing toilet paper into your cheeks.
Right.
Crazy stuff. But the whole idea behind this was to kind of hide in plain sight type of thing, because to have fled the country or gone to a border or whatever would have been too obvious.
Right.
He decided he needed to go deeper into the interior, which he did, until there became a point where, having made a connection with, well, for people who don't know, John at this point realized that he wanted to document this flight from Belize in as public a way as it could be done. And so he ended up getting guys from Vice magazine down to essentially document it all on the web in real time, on his blog, et cetera, make this big performance out of it. So they came down, and ultimately they accompanied him as he fled Belize via boat into Guatemala. And ultimately from Guatemala that he was shipped back to the US, but there was lots went on in between there, but
right.
Yeah, that was the mechanism of his escape.
He winds up in the US. He's in Miami. He gets this whole procedure where he looks out the window of the airplane and the terminal's closed and the cops come on and he says, "What have I done?" And they said, "You've done nothing. We're going to take you wherever you need to go." And
welcome home, Mr. McAfee.
You welcome home, Mr. McAfee. Yeah, yeah. He winds up early on, as he does, interacting with prostitutes. And yep. That approach him, probably want to roll him, steal his money, whatever. But he understands this, probably even respects them to a certain degree, and winds up meeting Janice, who becomes his wife again, even though she is on the record trying to kill him or trying to set him up so that he will get shipped back to Belize.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't know about you, man, but if my wife tried to kill me, it would be divorce city. But John McAfee is not your typical guy. How is the relationship with Janice? And did you ever have any interactions with her? Because I know that in the course of setting up interviews, I reached out to him as well and wound up emailing with Janice about trying to get John on to talk to him. And then immediately after that, Spain happened and it was over, so I didn't even bother. So what was your relationship, if any, with Janice?
Yeah, I mean, good. And still good. I'm still in contact with Janice. But at the beginning, John tried to make this our sort of interactions quite official. He'd say, everything must go through Janice. And you email her and she sets up the calls. Right. That went by the board after about 24 hours. We just did it ourselves. But there was a funny story, because during the one of our video calls, John was sitting there one day and Janice appeared over his shoulder with a cup of coffee, which she put down on the table beside him. And he all of a sudden made this sort of grand gesture. He said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, stop, stop. Drink this coffee, please, Janice." And I was sitting there thinking, what's going on here? And so Janice took a mouthful of this coffee and nodded, and John then nodded and put the coffee down. And he said, "You need to understand this, my friend. Janice has tried to kill me on several occasions in the past. If she's bringing me a drink, she needs to drink it first." And I said, "So do you not trust her?" He said, "I don't trust anyone." even now, at this point in our relationship, we are thrown together by the chaos of life. We're on the run. We're in hiding. I still don't trust her. So that is the situation. I actually believe him on that. I don't think he ever fully did trust Janice. And going back to what I said before about Messiah complex, I always saw John's motivation for his, I mean, obviously they liked each other. They did and loved each other. But I think John felt this responsibility to improve Janice's life. He saw what she'd been through. She was a prostitute in Baltimore. She'd lived a very rough life. And I think, you know, when they were thrown together outside the hotel in Miami, when, you know, literally the day he came back from Guatemala, I think John realized, this is my next project. And I don't mean that to denigrate Janice at all. No. I just mean he thought, this is the person I've got to save now. And he did that. He did everything he could to save her. And it got to the point where Janice was basically stuck in the McAfee world. And she's still stuck in it, unfortunately. Now, you know, after John's death, Janice is still in Spain, while John's body is still in a morgue somewhere. She was with him to the end and kind of tied into his issues to the end as well. But behind all that, there was a great deal of fondness. I do know that.
But to be fair and consistent, he regularly said that he didn't trust himself either, correct? Yep.
Yeah, I agree. And again, that goes back to that identification of human frailty, which I is the single thing I took most out of working with John, is that, you know, we've all got just such deep flaws. And to try and pretend that we don't, I think creates a very fake life. I think the moment you accept, you know, I've got some really shitty failings, and, you know, I'm basically a shit person some of the time. Some of the time I'm great, but a lot of the time I'm shitty. I think that makes life much easier. And John just always applied that.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the real question then that I know that a lot of people wonder. And that is because, you know, my little conspiratorial mind gets cooking when I hear about a guy committing suicide in a prison in Spain, guy that has access to resources, a guy that has faked heart attacks before to get out of certain things. This is a self-described slippery motherfucker. So how do we process the Spain suicide? Is it reasonable for us to consider the fact that he slipped out the back door somewhere, or have we settled this and proven once and for all that John McAfee is actually dead?
Let me say that I personally have been back and forth on this in about seven different directions in the months since John passed away. You know, you got a few options on the table. One of them is suicide. One of them is he was killed. The other is, as you say, John found a way to escape and is out there in the world somewhere laughing. Option three appeals most to me. I have to say that at this point, I'm in the suicide camp. As much as I would like to think there's more, I'm in the suicide camp. And I know that that flies against some of the features you just mentioned in terms of John being, I mean, he had so much life force. He was somebody who had faked heart attacks, faked strokes, as you said, you know, done everything he possibly could to keep living. I just think, I think this because of the visual image of him sitting in prison, giving his testimony over video call to the extradition hearing, he looked really very much broken. And I wonder whether after 8 months in a Spanish prison, he always said to me, listen, if I ever end up in a prison in the US, I'll just disappear. I think John's ego, and he did have an ego, would not have taken that. The idea of, you know, larger than life, John McAfee in some nameless prison somewhere in the Midwest or whatever, I just don't think he could have coped with that. And I think he might have weighed it all up and thought, okay, 75 years old, you know, I've had a pretty good run at things, you know, kind of broken physically. I could see the suicide angle. I could. As much as I know what you're saying, this is somebody who tried to live all the time. I just wonder whether, you know, he was forced into a position where he thought, you know, this might just be the end game.
John, if you're watching this, email me. Email Mark.
Yeah, please.
Do something. Send me a sign. Send us a package. Send something. The book is called No Domain. Where is the best place for people to purchase this, Mark?
It's on Amazon. It's in Barnes & Noble. It's the usual places. And what I want to say, just tacked on to the stuff about the prison, is that John and my plan was, you know, he approved of this book. My last communication when he was in prison was, you know, can't wait to read it. You know, we'll have a beer one day and we'll kind of walk off into the sunset. That was the plan with this. And it never happened. And it kind of left me in this position where I carry a great deal of responsibility to make sure the McAfee story is told. And I always promised him that that's what I would do. I'd be fair to him. And I think I was fair to him in this book. And I want people to know that, you know, John McAfee will obviously never write an autobiography now. He's not around to do it. But this is probably as close as we'll ever get. And the intention behind it, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, was that that's what this would be. So judge it as that, albeit with somebody kind of pushing back on some of the wilder stories, in order to give it a bit of balance and a bit of credibility, because some of the stories, if he'd been left to his own devices, would have been out of control. And I think there's enough out of control stuff in there as it is. So, yeah, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it in Barnes & Noble. And I hope anyone that picks it up gets some enjoyment out of it. Not just enjoyment, but also a bit of the sort of McAfee philosophy. So I think that's got some worth.
I thought it was well done. I thought it was very balanced. You didn't just take his word for everything. The communications, the dialogue, you pushed back on him in the areas that needed that. I think it paints a very honest picture of an interesting guy. I mean, you can say what you want about John McAfee, but he was a fascinating character, almost cartoonish in the way he portrayed himself. And I think that people that pick up this book will not be disappointed. It was fantastic. I read the whole thing like real quick. So great job on it, Mark. I really appreciate you sending it my way.
Yeah, thank you very much for giving it some coverage. I think John deserves coverage. And, you know, just on a sort of reading level, this is the kind of book you could read on the beach, like a sort of action adventure book. You could read it on that level. But the other side to it is that John throws out some breadcrumbs about the world we live in now and again, which if you want to read it on a slightly different level, you will find if you're paying attention. So I think it'll appeal to a lot of different readers on a number of different levels.
Well, if you're also on the run being chased by Belizean hitman team squads, you can read this in the bed of a pickup truck being covered up by tarps waiting for them to try and find you in Portland if you so choose. I'll be going to put the links in the description so everybody can just get right to the book that way. Mark, thank you so much for your amazing work on this book. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks very much. Really appreciate your time.
And if you guys enjoyed this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. If you want to connect with me, the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can follow me on Twitter @macroaggressions, and I will talk to you all soon.